Chairman, welcome everyone to the House Judiciary Committee. We apologize for our later start this afternoon. Our floor session ran over a little bit. We are going to begin.
205 today is unnecessary. It's off.
Okay.
I need it. So it's been pulled. 206.
We're going to.
Oh, actually, sorry. 2581.
Oh, okay. All right. Then we're going to begin with a work session on House Bill 2581. I'll open the work session and ask counsel to give us a. Do you want to tell us?
Sure.
What's up?
2581. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If you recall, this allows a municipality to have a court initiate a proceeding to determine the regularity and legality of certain actions of the governing body of that municipality. Last time we heard this bill, it was my understanding the committee wanted to hear from legislative counsel on a couple of issues, specifically one regarding the case and controversy issue, whether or not this does create a case for controversy, and second, an issue with respect to claim and issue preclusion and what would need to be pleaded in any type of complaint. And I've asked legislative counsel to be here, and Hannah Mills from LC is here to talk on that bill and address the committee's concerns.
Okay, Ms. Mills.
Hello, my name is Hannah Mills. I'm staff attorney for legislative counsel. Should I start with general questions, or do you want me to just go through it?
Yeah, I think it would be, in perhaps Representative Ackerman wants to direct the questioning. I think the committee's concern initially was the language in the bill that potentially created at least concern about the possibility of issue or claim preclusion for parties who were not party to the initial action seeking the determination. So, I mean, that was at least the question as I recall it. Did I state it fairly accurately, Representative Ackerman?
Yes, you did, Mr. Chairman.
So do you want to start there, Hannah, or do you want to back up? I mean, we'll hear whatever you want to tell us.
What exactly are you going for with the claim preclusion?
Well, the concern, I think, was that because the bill is, again, as I recall, and it's been a week or so since we had the hearing, but my recollection is that what the bill did was it prevented a procedure by which the governing body can go and effectively look to a proceeding or to get a decision if the decision meets certain criteria or if the action would have met certain criteria, and that the concern was that if they went forward and did that, and there was a period of time for other people who might have opposed the government's decision to do that, they would have to come in and participate in that. And so the question was, if they didn't do that, and the court said, yeah, this is fine, they went forward with the action, would people later be prohibited from coming forward and challenging that action, which was what the bill was essentially trying to accomplish?
The way this currently is written, it does not create a justiciable controversy. A municipality cannot go and just specifically ask for the legality of a regulation, ordinance, or whatever. For that to happen, there has to be an adverse party, and the adverse party has to have a problem with the specific provision of the act, and has to like if it's going to a constitutional issue, it has to be citing to a specific constitutional issue. So it cannot specifically ask, it cannot generally ask for the constitutionality of an ordinance or a resolution. So if a governing body did try and go ahead and bring an action under this section, just generally saying is it constitutional, just generally looking at the act, most likely, first of all, a court would not hear that because the court does not have the authority to do so. If for some reason the court did go ahead and do that, then I don't think it would be binding on any other party. A party could later come in and point at a specific provision and ask for the constitutionality of that.
Okay, Representative Ackerman?
Yes, just a couple questions. You're aware of the existing law, ORS 33.720, which does set up a notice requirement, which would, I guess, invite persons to enter into proceedings as defendants. Is that your interpretation of that provision?
Yes, it provides notice to parties.
Okay. So if notice is given to a party and a party actually does file an answer and joins the issues specified in the complaint, then we do have a justiciable controversy that a court can rule upon. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Likewise, I think you didn't hear the testimony on this bill, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay. I think there was testimony primarily from Mayor Tory of the City of Eugene that, aside from the notice requirement, that there could be a staff effort of the governing body to identify interested parties or interested groups that might be willing to file answers and litigate the case. Does that sound like also a solution that would produce a case or controversy for the court's decision?
If the staff is just saying that there might be an issue.
Excuse me?
I'm just trying to clarify your question. A staff would say that there might be a controversial issue. Is that what you're saying?
No, that there would be, aside from the notice requirement, the staff might contact interested public interest groups that would become parties to the proceeding. And if they did so, that would make it a controversy for the court's decision. Is that right?
Right, if other parties were involved.
Okay. On claim preclusion, are you familiar with the language in ORS 33.720 sub 6? This is existing law that says, quote, claim preclusion and issue preclusion apply to all matters adjudicated in the proceeding. Have you considered that on that issue?
I have not looked at this subsection before now.
Sub 6.
Representative, could you repeat the language you just quoted?
The statute?
Yeah, the one you just read.
The statute is ORS 33.720 sub 6, quote, claim preclusion and issue preclusion apply to all matters adjudicated in the proceeding. Close quotes.
And so what is your question involving that?
Well, had an issue regarding claim preclusion or issue preclusion to report to us, did you consider that statute in your analysis?
I did not consider that part of the statute in my analysis.
Would it also be your experience that if a complaint was filed to determine the validity of certain municipal action, that if the complaint did identify all relevant issues, that would be a matter by which issue preclusion could be avoided?
I think the courts have difficulties giving a ruling when they do not know every issue that could possibly happen or that could possibly arise. They may be willing to address everything that would come in under that proceeding, but that does not mean they would close the door to other issues that may come up that were not specifically addressed.
Of course, that problem is inherent in any litigation, is
correct.
It not?
Yeah.
Okay. It's not unique to this proceeding.
No.
Okay.
Representative, if I might.
You, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the risk of losing my law license here, I think I might go back to law school. And if you recall, there was a doctrine called offensive non-mutual collateral estoppel. And I think that's what a little bit of what we're talking about here. And
my school. I think it's all defense.
No, it was there. You guys just don't remember it.
What it means is...
Is that a bar review court?
See, I passed the California bar as well, which had a whole extra day on this one topic alone. And what that would be is you have the municipality going to court to have one of its actions declared regular and legal, and you give the notice that's required by the statute, and a party just doesn't happen to read the back of the paper where those notices appears, never gets notice, comes forward at a later date and says, wait a minute, we have a problem with this policy now that it's implemented. We want to fight the issue in court. And the municipality defends using the doctrine of issue and claim preclusion, saying, no, this matter has been litigated. It's offensive in the in that it's an affirmative defense being offered against a party. It's non-mutual because the party was not involved in the prior action. There are specific requirements that need to be met to exercise that type of a defense. And one of those is that there has to be a party in the original action, not the same party that is now suing, but a party that would have stood in the same shoes as the party that is now suing, such that the issue that the court now has before it was necessarily litigated to a full extent with interested parties who would have brought up largely the same arguments. And I think in this situation, you're very unlikely to have that unless the notice triggered the involvement of another party that had the same interest and litigated that particular issue. And so, therefore, I don't necessarily think the collateral estoppel or issue and claim preclusion, as they're now called, the other term is res judicata, would apply if the party that was now suing brings forth a point that was not directly addressed in the original action pursuant to this new statute.
Is that doctrine recognized in Oregon?
I believe it is. I believe it is based strictly on case law.
But isn't that issue? Wouldn't that issue be inherent in almost any case in which a declaratory judgment is being sought? Not necessarily unique to this case.
It's very hard to say, not knowing the facts of each case or each declaratory judgment, what the circumstances are. I mean, yes, many of the issues will be addressed, but there's always some other issue that could be brought to the court's attention that was not before it at the earlier proceeding that I think the party bringing that matter before the court would be unfairly prejudiced if they could not litigate that because there was a prior court action which did not involve the traditional litigation that we're all usually aware of.
And one more question, Mr.
Yes,
sir. The issues that we've discussed this afternoon really are applicable to the existing law, not the amendments which are sought. The amendments which I'm seeking are just an expansion of the issues that can be raised in the litigation. Is that would be a correct statement, counsel?
Representative Ackerman, are you referencing the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments, or are you referencing the actual bill itself?
The actual bill itself.
Okay. Well, I guess I would suggest that I think it's broader because right now certainly you can seek declaratory you can file a DEC action, but again I don't think currently it allows a local government to come forward and say we're thinking about doing this. Somebody might complain because we're going to spend some money on it. We want to know whether or not we can do it or not. I don't think that's currently I don't think a place that you can go. Typically you got to have a party on the other side, and it's got to be a determination about the existence of a contract or some other obligation that the court's going to have to make that determination on. So it seems like this does broaden it. And again, I don't know whether or not this doctrine of offensive non-mutual collateral estoppel. How it currently fits in. But I guess my hesitancy a little bit to move on this now, still not completely comfortable that once we do it, that it will necessarily provide the protection that a local government really wants, which is that determination as to whether or not they can or can't go forward. If all it does is answer that question to a particular group, but leaves open the possibility of whatever they've done being attacked collaterally again, I don't know that we've really done much except enhance a lot of litigation. Now I see Christy Monson from the League of Oregon Cities sitting there, who I have on good authority has a law degree. Christy, do you know anything about offensive non-mutual collateral estoppel?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Christy Munson with the League of Oregon Cities. I tend to have wiped out all information I had once having taken the bar and pass. However, the League applauds this attempt and understands that there may be constitutional and other problems with the bill, but applauds the attempt and would like to see the bill pass if possible and have problems ironed out if possible.
I'm glad I got back for that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that was really helpful. If possible.
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, counsel.
The fact is that this bill, while I do have concerns about the case or controversy issue, assuming that notice gets to a party that has a particular point to argue, and that point is decided in a litigation with two opposing sides, even if that litigation is engendered by this bill and the rights it's giving the municipalities, that issue would be decided then. And I think whether or not you believe in the whole non-mutual collateral estoppel, that issue will have been decided and litigated necessarily as part of the decision, and a party would not be able to bring that particular issue forward. That's not to say that other issues might not crop up, but at least it would decide certain issues.
Well, let me make a concluding remark.
Yeah, please do.
I think these comments are relevant. However, they're inherent in any litigation in which a declaratory judgment is being sought. I think the way that, and we're talking how the existing law works, is that if a complaint was filed, a notice was given, and people filed answers in that litigation, we would have real parties and real controversy. I also believe that counsel drafting such a complaint would set it up so that the major issues being sought to be resolved by the city or the governing body would be in the complaint, so it would be ripe for adjudication, and we wouldn't have these problems. I think the only time we have these problems is if the complaint was so thinly drafted that it left issues hanging out. I don't see counsel doing that.
Okay. Any further questions for Ms. Mills or Ms. Munson? Thank you. I have a -1 and a -2 amendment. One is obviously an emergency clause. I can read that one. Explain to me what the -2 amendment does, counsel, or do these come from you?
These do not come from me, Mr. Chairman. The -2 amendment inserts the word body on page 2, line 2 of the bill, and I think it's expanding.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, it's after the word body,
after the word
the constitutionality of the ordinance, resolution, or regulation.
And where did these amendments come from, are we aware? Anyone taking ownership of the -2s? All right.
You.
Did they come from you, Representative Ackerman?
No. There was a request on the emergency clause that may have come from me. But I'm
essentially, it looks like the -2s allow the court to rule on the constitutionality of the ordinance before it was the authority of the governing body to enact the ordinance.
Yeah, I'll claim that, too.
Okay, so the -2s are yours?
Yes, they are now.
Okay, all right. Okay.
In other words, the court is now going to say, not only do you, municipality, have the authority to do this, but we find that this action is constitutional.
Okay.
Okay. I have a motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ackerman.
I'll move that the -2 amendments to House Bill 2581 be incorporated within that bill.
Representative Ackerman moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2581. Is there discussion on this motion? Any objection? The -2s are adopted.
Chairman, I have a second motion.
Representative Ackerman.
Move that the -1 amendments to House Bill 2581 be incorporated within the bill.
Representative Ackerman moves the amendments, the -1 amendments to House Bill 2581. Is there discussion? Objection. The -1s are in the bill.
Third motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ackerman.
I'll move that House Bill 2581 as amended be forwarded to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves House Bill 2581 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on this motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shirley.
I'm inclined to oppose. We'll see how the vote goes. But I am concerned, I think, about the claim preclusion and just the risk of friendly participants in this that might have some effect of barring opportunity for a more complete and fairer and fuller vetting of issues that might arise under the circumstances. I understand what the purpose of it is, and I respect that, but I've got some concerns about the ability of one party to arrange the filing of a suit to challenge its own actions and obtain a favorable result and effectively bar others that, apart from notice in the legal section of the paper, might not have had a real opportunity to participate and assert their own claims or objections.
Okay. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure that there must have been an attempt to answer this as we went through the discussion. But having not been to law school in either Oregon or California, the first question is if we're going to have to be responsible for that information on a quiz that counsel should today. The second question, however, is the issue I think that I raised at the last time we met and heard this bill, and that is basically the separation of powers issue. I'm not sure that I heard an answer to that, and I'm somewhat uncomfortable that while I understand the purpose of this is efficiency and try to move things faster, I'm uncomfortable with the kind of delegation of what would be legislative lawmaking authority, but basically to the court by having the group, you know, go to the court before we make the law. I just am nervous about that, and if I'd missed it in the legal arguments that have taken place, my apologies for that.
No, Representative, I don't think that issue was discussed today or to any great degree the last time the bill was heard. Does anybody want to take a crack, Representative Ackerman, at responding to Representative Jensen's concerns?
Well, I can just make an overall statement to maybe address also the concerns stated by Representative Shetterly. Legislative Council reported that this statute has been used successfully 11 times before. The PUC has reported to me that they've used it once successfully, which means that they have filed the complaint, produced a notice, and real parties have entered in the proceeding to make it a case or controversy for a decision. I think that this is a valuable tool for municipalities to obtain a court ruling on some of their actions before they engage in the project and before they expend vast sums of money, which may be challenged 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the line, which would visit upon the city tremendous financial liability. This is a tool. It's like any piece of litigation. It's an imperfect tool, but I think it's a tool that some municipalities and some governing bodies need to have in order to seek a early validation of their actions, which may involve vast expenditures of money or involve unique points of law. I think that the defects in the bill are going to have to be met with creative pleading and presentation of the issues in the court, but I think that's a question of what counsel does, not a question that should be reserved to our judgment.
Okay. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a former local government person, I very fully appreciate what Representative Ackerman has done by bringing this bill forward, and I supported it when it was in the concept stage, and I still support it. I think that what you would actually find is that jurisdictions, whether it be cities or counties or special districts or school districts, would use this very seldom. But when they do have an issue that would raise a novel issue, there might be times that it would be worthwhile to have the court take a look at it. I recognize that unless there's a controversy, the court does not necessarily have jurisdiction. But I think that if, you know, and from what I heard earlier, and I maybe I'm kind of clarifying too, is that if I thought that I was going to be damaged by something that the city was going to do, as an example, and notice had been served that they were going to move forward with that, then this would give me an opportunity to come forward and say, I think that what you're about to do is going to create a problem for me, is going to damage me in some way, and therefore I'm going to file a claim to or file a suit to try to stop you from moving forward with it, and thereby we've created a justiciable controversy. And so I think that the merits of the bill I think are good. And I recognize some of the concerns that Representative Shetterly and Representative Jensen may have with it, but I think that at the same time it's a tool that we can give to our local government officials.
Okay. All right. The motion is to move the bill as amended to the floor. Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Marker.
Aye.
Jensen.
No.
Hummel.
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Wazowski?
A weak aye.
I'll take it.
You'll take it.
Votes aye. House Bill 2581 as amended moves to the Representative Krasanski.
I think there's one thing that we didn't discuss. I was hesitating whether to bring it up or not, but maybe.
Well, right before I bang the gavel is not usually the most auspicious time to do it.
Put on the record so Representative Ackerman may be able to address it.
How often this may actually be used in the courts, because one of the things I'm thinking about is if you do see a lot of jurisdictions going in and using this as a remedy, we're going to be asking the court to do a lot more work. And so,
food for thought.
All right, on a vote of 5-2, the bill moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, Representative Ackerman to carry.
Five.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. 7-2. I got to move my pen. All right. 7-2. I apologize.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
The answer I didn't get to one of the questions I had, though, is A, whether we're going to have a quiz, and B, if this will be important for those of us who are not members of the bar in our using this committee as a stepping stone to such lofty standards.
Well, I'll just tell you, Representative Jensen, at the committee dinner, if you don't score above a 70, you don't get your food. So I just want you to be aware of how the scoring is going to go. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2066. Colleagues, this is the court bill. You'll recall this is the their bill that had a number of small fix-it issues in it, as I recall, counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last hearing, we adopted the -15s and the -16s were adopted.
Right.
We held the bill because there was some discussion about whether there would be additional amendments that might be coming into this bill. I don't believe there is going to be any, and so what you have is the bill before you amended with the -15s and 16s.
My understanding was to remove the subject. We're all getting the amendments.
Right. So I want you to, we've already adopted the 15s and the 16s, but if you have a question, we can talk about them. The bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but it's our understanding that there is, in fact, even with the adoption of the 15s and 16s, no fiscal impact. So it would be the chair's intent to take a motion to rescind the Ways and Means referral and to refer the bill as currently amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
If you're ready, I'll move House Bill. I'll move that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded on House Bill 2066 and that House Bill 2066 as amended be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves that the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee on House Bill 2066 be rescinded and that House Bill 2066 as amended be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Okay. Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Marker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Powell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Zemanski?
Strong aye.
Aye. House Bill 2066 is amended. Moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry that bill. We've got a lot of people here to talk about 2080, so I'm going to try to get through some other housekeeping with the committee before we do that. So I'm going to now move to a work session on House Bill 2279. I'll open the work session on 2279. You'll recall we had this one up just at the end of a long hearing the other day. There were some questions about the amendments. It relates to the changes to the revised Uniform Arbitration Act. Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, we previously adopted the Dash 4 amendments, and we were discussing the Dash 3, and there were some questions as to what they do, and I understand the proponents are here to talk about those, and in the meantime, I will pass out what I received by email today, which is a written explanation of what the Dash 3s do. So maybe.
Yeah, that's fine. If you want to come forward, Joyce, do you want to come up as well? Welcome again, Mr. Demas. Appreciate you being here. Again, I think you gave us a pretty good rundown last time. I don't know that we need a lot of detail. If you could just sort of focus us on the dashboards, I think, solve the insurance industry's concerns with the bill. So if you just want to give us a short rundown on what the Dash 3s do, that would be appreciated.
James Damus, attorney representing the Oregon State Bar, which proposed the bill and also proposes these amendments. As indicated on the one-page sheet, on page 6 of the printed bill, the amendment begins by expanding Section 16 to allow an out-of-state, a non-Oregon attorney, appear in an Oregon arbitration. There's simply no procedure that would allow a court the jurisdiction to allow a non-Oregon attorney to appear in an Oregon arbitration in the same way that a court could allow an out-of-state attorney to appear in state court actions. And especially with people who live across the river and often California attorneys involved in arbitrations. Arbitration is fairly informal compared with the necessity of in court learning specific Oregon court rules that it simply doesn't make a lot of sense to not allow an out-of-state attorney to appear in an Oregon arbitration. Another part of this is to allow a corporation to be represented in an arbitration by an employee or an officer of the corporation or the entity. We have this Oregon statute that says corporations can only be represented by an attorney in legal proceedings, and sometimes in arbitration you get one side saying that only an attorney can represent a corporation in an arbitration proceeding. Arbitrators tend to not listen to that and allow a corporation to appear through an employee or an agent or officer. But it seems that only fair to allow a corporation the same kind of pro se status as an individual might have, especially recognizing the informality that arbitration is. On page 7 in section 17, it simply proposes that an attorney in arbitration has the same power to, on the attorney's own signature, issue a subpoena to a witness to appear at an arbitration hearing. Attorneys have that same power to, on their own signature, to issue a witness to appear in a trial. So there seems to be no logical reason to force a party to submit the subpoena first to the arbitrator, who automatically signs, and then get it back to the party to have it served. It's just a wasteful and time-consuming process. So this would allow an attorney the same right to subpoena witnesses to an arbitration hearing. And on pages 9 and 10, it would revise sections that deal with what happens in court. When the award is presented for confirmation, ultimately be judgment, or when someone wants to ask the court to vacate an arbitrator's award or to amend the award. And what this amendment proposes is to ensure that notice of any proposed action to a court be given to any adverse party. And what this amendment would do is to adopt the same amendments that now exist under our local arbitration statute. These amendments that were changes to the original Uniform Arbitration Act of 1955 when Oregon adopted its version. It put these special notices provisions in there. And the last thing that it would do in terms of those sections is to change the time limit that a person has that triggers what the objections that a party might have to the award to 20 days after someone wants to confirm the award. The existing uniform or the revised act says you've got 90 days from the date of the award, and this says you've got 20 days after someone wants to do something with the award, that is, submits it for confirmation. And there doesn't seem to be any reason why someone should have to do something within 90 days. Let the triggering device be when someone wants to confirm the award. And that, again, is the same thing as currently exists in the Oregon statute. It adopts that 20-day triggering device. And the last part of it on pages 24, 26, and 29 are requests of the state, the Construction Contractors Board and the Landscape Contractors Board, which under their own sections of the statute have until 2004 to develop rules to govern arbitration procedures as a method of resolving claims that are brought against construction contractors or landscape contractors. They haven't drafted those rules yet. And these particular amendments simply give them the broader leeway that they would need to more appropriately draft arbitration rules that govern the arbitration of these claims. And those claims are not to be arbitrated unless both parties agree that they should be arbitrated. And so when the Contractors Board and the Landscape Contractors Board draft those arbitration rules for those particular claims, they're simply asking for certain exceptions and exemptions that would give them appropriate methods of dealing with it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Demas. We appreciate it. So we've adopted the dash fours. We have the dash threes in front of us. They need to be adopted. Representative Shetterly.
I have a question and then a motion, or do you want a motion first?
No, question's fine.
I was just going to ask in the amendment to section 16 in the dash threes. I know when lawyers are admitted to practice on a pro hoc vice, where you bring them in out of state, they pay a fee to the court. And in fact, we amended that last session to help fund legal services with that. Did you intentionally leave that out for appearance in an arbitration, or is it something we should consider perhaps in the Senate, or is it just impractical in an arbitration? I'm not sure how that works.
Well, because it's not in the court system at all yet, it's still private arbitration, that there would be no need to exact a fee from them in this private sphere.
Need or opportunity, but Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash threes.
Representative Shetterly has made a motion on the dash three amendments. Is there any discussion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I didn't have these amendments so that I could have maybe done some homework on it. And I don't know that I understand enough about subpoenaing witnesses. Subpoenaing these witnesses, are they then sworn witnesses when they're appearing before the arbitration?
Mr. Demas?
Representative Williams, Representative Jensen, the normal practice in the arbitration is to have the witness sworn, but that's up to the rules if the arbitration services. All the arbitration services I know require swearing of the witnesses.
Okay. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Continue. when we have witnesses subpoenaed, then what? I mean, do we have the same perjury rules or laws present if they fail to be truthful with us?
Representative Williams and Representative Jensen, lying under oath is lying under oath under lying under oath. And the current practice, of course, is to allow, or the Uniform Act allows the, because the state has is pro-arbitration and has a Uniform Act that says parties can agree to resolve a dispute by arbitration rather than a court, as a way of effecting that process, it's under the court statute that allows the service of a subpoena to force witnesses to come in the same way that parties could enforce witnesses to come to a trial. And it's just a matter of allowing the attorney as well as the arbitrator to sign these subpoenas.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Just a question then, does this subpoenaing of witnesses create a more adversarial atmosphere as far as the arbitration hearing is concerned? And if so, is that a desirable effect?
Representative Williams and Representative Jensen, arbitration would have to be classified as an adversarial proceeding to the extent that you have people arguing about something in the same way that they could argue in court. The purpose of the subpoena is to ensure that the parties have the ability to force people to come and testify on their behalf. And that's why the subpoena power exists in court, and that's why it exists in the statute that creates arbitration, because witnesses who have no interest in the outcome say, I'd rather stay at home, I'd rather go on vacation, I'd rather stay at work, don't involve me. But everyone usually at one time of their life is in court or is somehow involved in an adversarial contest that they need the participation, the testimony of someone who doesn't care how it turns out there, and only a subpoena, only the power of the subpoena can have that person there.
Chair, I recognize that the fact that we're in arbitration is an adversarial relationship. There's a disagreement between parties. The concern was whether subpoenas would create a greater adversarial relationship or atmosphere than we would have under normal conditions or under other conditions in the arbitration. But we'll go ahead from there.
Yeah, Representative Jensen, it is really true that it's very difficult to get somebody who isn't a party to the case to show up and want to talk about something that they don't have an interest in. And without the ability to subpoena, you just don't have the ability to draw people into the controversy to give potentially critical testimony about the facts. So I don't know that it makes it any more or less adversarial, because both sides have the power and both sides will use it to subpoena their witnesses. That would be my response to your question. Okay, the motion is to adopt the dash threes. You made the motion, didn't you, Representative?
I did.
Okay. So, did we adopt the dash threes already?
No.
All right, so that's the motion. Is there any objection? The dash threes are in the bill.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 2279 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2279 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Go ahead and call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Rummel?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Devonsi?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2279 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Volunteer carrier.
Well, no,
you've got your fill, Floyd. We'll give Representative Barker that one then today.
Absolutely.
Want to spread the wealth here. Let's do 2235. Open a work session. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2275.
2235.
I'm sorry. 2235 regards private security providers. Last time we heard this bill, Representative Fazansky expressed some concern regarding Section 7 of the original bill, which dealt with some citizenship issues. It's my understanding that the Dash 1 amendments, which you should have in front of you, remove that section. The Dash 2 amendments, which you have also have in front of you, make some technical changes to the bill, and specifically, they allow a representative from the alarm monitoring industry to sit on the advisory committee. And other than that, I think the bill is ready to go.
Scott, do you want to come up? You want to identify yourself for the record, and then I'll ask you a question.
Okay. For the record, my name is Scott Tai, and I'm the Division Director for the Standards and Certification Division for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
And Mr. Burke Sivers, you want to identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm Harold Burke Sivers. I'm the Director of Public Safety at the University of Portland and Chair of the Private Security Advisory Committee, and also a board member for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Thanks for coming up. I just want to make sure that we're doing this right. Did we adopt any amendments in the prior hearing?
Not that I know of.
Okay, so we have in front of us a Dash 1 and a Dash 2. Is it DPSST's wish that we adopt both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments?
Chair Williams, that's correct.
Okay. All right, that's what I needed to know. Are there questions for either these gentlemen about the impact of the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s? Okay. I think you're done. Thanks. All right. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Prozanski.
I will move for adoption the Dash 1 and 2235.
Representative Prozanski moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2235. Is there discussion? Objection? They're in.
Mr. Chair, I now move the Dash 2 into 2235.
Representative Prozanski moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2235. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The Dash 2s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2235 to the floor with the, as amended, to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Prozanski moves House Bill 2235 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Call the roll.
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Hall?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye. Aye. House Bill 2235 is amended. Moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Anderson, would you carry that one?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. We are not, just so the committee knows, going to work 2053, which I understand has been withdrawn, and we are not going to work 3318.
Not ready.
Because we don't have the amendments back for the committee's consideration. So that should give you a little bit more of a roadmap. We're now going to do 2103, open a work session, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, if you recall, House Bill 2103 dealt with the customer receipts for restaurants, Visa customer receipts typically, that print the Visa card number, sometimes the person's address, their name, et cetera, other information that can be used to steal somebody's identity. We have Dash 1 amendments in front of us. There was some discussion last time that the bill, as originally drafted, only allowed the printing of the last four digits of your credit card number and nothing else. And there was some concern that that wasn't going to be enough to identify the transaction. And so, as I understand it, the Dash 1 amendments expand that to 5 digits. Also, there were some concerns addressed that not having the customer's name on the receipt would lead to confusion with customers getting the wrong receipt. So the Dash 1 amendments also allow the use of the name and the last 5 digits of their credit card. Finally, there are some changes to the amount of time that records can be kept before being destroyed, making it 36 months at which point they should be transferred to microfiche and then the original hard copy shredded or otherwise destroyed.
Okay, is there anybody here to speak to the Dash 1 amendments on 2103? Ms. Pellegrini, it's nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. Just to expand a little bit on committee counsel statements, the obliteration requirements now apply only to the customer copy, and that was in response to a concern voiced by Associated Oregon Industries that some small merchants retain the merchant's copy and rely on all the information in that copy for purposes of dealing with the credit card companies. That fact moved us to create the section that committee counsel just mentioned to provide that as soon as the merchant's copy is transferred to microfiche, it's to be destroyed. Or in any event, they can't hold it more than 36 months. The effective dates have changed a little bit, and that's in Section 6 of the bill, I believe. Section 6 now provides that after the effective date of the bill, which will be January 1st, 2004, entities that distribute these machines must be distributing machines that comply with the bill. Merchants themselves have a little bit longer time to make the switch, so the provisions do not apply to merchants until July 1st, 2005. That gives them approximately 18 months so that they can conclude their current leases. I believe those are all of the changes contained in the Dash 1 amendments. And I would note that the Attorney General's office met with representatives of Associated Oregon Industries, Oregon Bankers Association, Safeway, and I don't know if I'm forgetting someone else, but most of the interest groups that had expressed concern.
And these are consensus amendments. Is that a good way to describe them?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pellegrini. Are there questions before we let her go? Thank you. Okay. Anybody else here to talk about amendments to 2103? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
Move the Dash 1s into House Bill 2103.
Representative Przanski moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2103. Is there discussion? Objection? The Dash 1s are in the bill.
Move the bill that's amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2103 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay. Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Parker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Rummel.
Aye.
Burson.
Aye.
Zonsky.
Aye.
Chatterley.
Aye.
Chairway.
Aye. House Bill 2103 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Representative Crummell, are you up for this one?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Work session on House Bill 2658. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2658, which we previously heard, relates to disclosure of Social Security numbers and exempts public employees' Social Security numbers from such disclosure under the public records law. The last time we heard the bill, there was a discussion regarding elected officials' Social Security numbers. Specifically, the discussion revolved around the fact that elected officials' address and identifying information and their dates of birth specifically are public record and are available to the public. However, there's a process, if you look in the bill on the first page, line 19, where certain elected officials, specifically those involved in law enforcement, can have their identifying information exempted from disclosure. The discussion was that there's no public policy reason to have other elected officials, such as you gentlemen or people in the Senate, have their Social Security numbers subject to publication under the public records law, and so that the Social Security numbers of elected officials should be specifically exempted, and if the elected officials identified here, specifically those in law enforcement, wanted to have more than just their Social Security numbers exempted from publication, they would just have to make an application to do so. That's what the Dash 1 amendments do, and it's my understanding that these I asked for these specifically, so not sure anybody will be here to speak on them.
Okay. This was an issue that came up, as you recall, I think. Was it you, Representative Shirley, who raised the issue?
Could have been. It's been a while.
It has been a while. All right. Let me ask, is there anybody here to speak to the Dash 1 amendments on House Bill 2658? Anybody here to speak to House Bill 2658 at all? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
If you're ready for a motion, I'll move the Dash 1s in the House Bill 2658.
All right. Representative Przanski moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2658. Is there discussion? Objection? They're in.
Move House Bill 2658 to commit to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2658 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there discussion on that motion? Okay, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Aye.
Arthur.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Rummel.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Zonsky.
Aye.
Chadwick.
Aye.
House Bill 2658 is amended, moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson, if you'd carry that one. Okay.
Last one.
Open work session on House Bill 2080. And we're going to take, because we tapped this bill, call this into a full hearing, we are going to take testimony on this bill. And I'm going to invite up Mr. Rich Lane and whoever else on the team for the proponents wants to come up and present to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to speak in favor of the bill, House Bill 2080, and the Dash amendments that you have in front of you. With me is Linda Ironman, who has been the primary drafter behind some of the changes and work on our committee, and I'd allow her to speak in favor of 2080.
Hi, Linda. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Williams, members of the committee, I just want to let you know that my practice does involve products liability cases in large part and has for many years. I represent injured people who've been harmed by defective products, and I also have been active in the Oregon State Bar Products Liability Section. I was 8 years on the executive committee, and I was chair of the Products Liability Section in 2001. I think that's important background just because I do want to help you understand how the law changed in the year 2001, at least from what we believed it to be. It changed radically. But first I should say that the purpose of the main bill, and in large part the Dash 1 amendments, is to add an explicit discovery rule into the 2-year statute of limitations for products liability actions. This bill has nothing to do with what's called the statute of ultimate repose. That's an 8-year rule that says no matter when the injury, harm, or claim arose, you cannot, the courthouse door closes at the end of 8 years. And there's a small exception to that that may come up. But I just want to make the point, this is not a bill intended to change the statute of ultimate repose. We would love to change it, but not this bill, not this session. The reason that we are looking to put an explicit discovery rule into ORS 3905 is because in the year 2001, the Oregon Supreme Court totally shocked practitioners on both sides of the fence and the lower courts by deciding a case, the name of which is Gladhart versus Oregon Vineyard Supply Company. And I'll tell you why that was a shock. The case itself was brought by two farmers, husband and wife, in the wine country. They had purchased wine grape rootstock from Oregon Vineyard Supply Company, and unbeknownst to them, the stock was infested with phylloxera, which is a microscopic bug like an aphid that eventually kills the plants. It took about 4 years for the Gladharts to grow the plants to the point where they discovered their harm. They then filed a lawsuit against the company they bought the plants from within 2 years of the date they discovered their harm. And the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that they were too late. Even though our law said you have 2 years to bring a lawsuit, what the court said is effectively that they had 2 years from the date they purchased the product to bring the lawsuit, even though they had no clue that there was anything wrong with the product. And the effect was that their rights expired before they even knew about them. I have to tell you that that is not the way that Oregon law was before the Gladhart case. What the court did is they looked at the literal language of the law and not the context in which it existed. We have had case law, judicially created law in Oregon since 1966, which says that essentially is a discovery rule, is what it's called. And it says that you have however many years, generally 2 years, not from the date of purchase, but from when you discover or reasonably should have discovered your claim to bring a lawsuit. That was the state of the law when ORS 30.905 was enacted in 1977. Two cases were decided the very next years that made that very clear. And in 1982, the appellate courts decided a case called Dorsch, which involved a defective birth control device, where they said, I mean, as clear as can be, that in cases brought under ORS 30.905, products liability cases, there is a discovery rule, and you have 2 years from when you discover your claim to bring a lawsuit. So that's the context in which I've been practicing my whole legal career. It's the context that other attorneys have been practicing in. We never heard any complaints about the fact that we had a discovery rule, but the Oregon Supreme Court, following what is, I have to say, somewhat of a new policy in a case called PGE versus Boley, where they no longer want to look at the context. They only want to look at the language of the statute, went the other way in Gladhart. So we really need an explicit discovery rule in this statute in order to give Oregonians their day in court. At this point, the effect is 2 years after the purchase and the courthouse door is closed, which really makes no sense because we have an 8-year statute of ultimate repose, which says that 8 years after first purchase, the courthouse door is closed. We don't need that statute anymore if we don't have discovery. So what we're trying to do is basically put the state of the law back where it was for Oregon consumers before the Gladhart decision. A couple of other points about this. At this point, products liability actions are the only area of tort law in Oregon that don't have a discovery provision. We have one in medical malpractice, we have one in general negligence, and quite a few other areas. So now products liability is really the aberration in having this very short time period to bring a claim. That's really not good as a matter of policy, because if you have more than one party in the case, for example, a pharmaceutical manufacturer and a doctor, the drug company could be out of the case based on this Gladhart rule, with the doctor left holding the bag for all the responsibility, and that's really not fair. Consistency is important in this area of the law. Also, inconsistency creates a lot of confusion for young lawyers, out-of-state lawyers who are practicing in this state under our new reciprocity rules, and attorneys who are trying to bring cases when they're not specialists in this area. If the older cases tell us that we have a discovery rule, and most of the areas of tort practice have a discovery rule, then we shouldn't be surprised if they believe we have a discovery rule. We really need the consistency that this change would bring about, and that we've always had in our practice. Finally, if we stay with this Gladhart rule and don't amend the statute to add a discovery rule, Oregon will have one of the shortest, if not the shortest, statutes of limitations and repose in the entire country. Very unfair to Oregon consumers, and actually a very favorable environment for out-of-state manufacturers who come and sell their products here. Instead of protecting our people, our consumers, we're protecting out-of-state businesses. Now, the Dash 1 amendments, there are three purposes to those amendments. The first is simply to better define the discovery rule by stating the particular elements that an injured person has to have discovered before they're deemed to have a claim. One of them is the specific harm that's been caused. A second one is the specific wrong that the defendant has done for which they're bringing suit. The language was drafted in its form by legislative counsel and is consistent with other statutes in the state in terms of the language. There also is another housekeeping matter that is incorporated in the Dash 1 amendments, and that has to do with the statute of limitations in cases of death. Rather than having that be the same 2 years from discovery rule, it is 3 years from the date of death, which is consistent with the general Oregon Wrongful Death Act statute of limitations, and becomes important again for consistency. We have practiced for 25 years believing that it was 3 years from death from a combination of court decisions and the way things were done. And again, the Oregon Supreme Court threw a curve when they decided another recent case where they looked again at the plain language of 3905 and said death will be treated the same. So this is an amendment that is important, again, for consistency, so that attorneys handling death cases have one statute of limitations for all death cases. The third part of the amendments that is new simply seeks to revive those few cases that so far have been dismissed based on Gladhart and let those people have their day in court, providing they bring their claim timely. So, may I take questions?
Yes, are there questions for Ms. Ironman? Representative Barker.
Thank you. Ms. Ironman, just to clarify, this doesn't change the 8-year, one of the original complaints from the, or the other side that I heard from lobbyists said that this would essentially eliminate the state of repose.
We have no intention to change the statute of repose at all.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Let me ask about on the dash one amendments. Linda, the section two, and you almost have to chart it out, but section two goes through a fairly laborious process that includes revival of actions.
Yes.
And by and large, not universally by any stretch of the imagination, but by and large, we're pretty hesitant to sort of go back and, you know, wave the magic wand and revive cases that otherwise wouldn't exist in these kinds of changes. I guess I'm interested in what's the thought behind all the language in Section 2 relating to the revival of actions. And it would be helpful for someone to actually sort of talk us through how it works, because there are sort of, you know, dates and periods in which cases have to be in a certain status, and if they're not, then they can, you know, you can opt and by dismissing and then refiling, and I guess I just want to have an understanding about that.
I think the intent is to be fairly specific to a category of cases that was dismissed only based on the Gladhart rule, not for any other reason. And it had to have been dismissed within 2 years of the effective date of the new law. So we can't go back forever. But it should pick up most of the cases that were dismissed because of Gladhart. And there are not a lot, but there are some. And it doesn't automatically revive them. It requires action on the part of the plaintiff. And they must do something within 1 year of the effective date of the bill or they're forever barred. This is similar, Representative Williams, to the revival provision that was in the breast implant exception statute. And there were a few cases that were affected, and what it did is it gave those plaintiffs the same opportunity as others, nothing more, nothing less.
My next question is on lines 8 through 13 of the Dash 1 amendment. It lays out this criteria of, as you pointed out, sort of making the discovery rule more specific.
Yes.
Is this language borrowed from another place in statute, or is this an attempt to sort of codify case law with respect to the discovery rule?
This was drafted by legislative counsel.
Right.
A little different than what we submitted. I believe it's borrowed from ORS 30.908, which is the exception for the breast implants. The closest I can track it.
Representative Williams, members of the committee, I would add to your question on lines 8 to 13, it's a case called Gaston versus Parsons. It's a medical malpractice case, and it actually defines and walks through the necessary information that somebody needs to have in order to commence an action. So it's not exactly that language, but that's the framework in defining when somebody has discovered or should have discovered a claim in which they should commence.
Okay. Are there further questions?
May I add something just for clarification on that? Another reason why the Gladhart case shocked us so much is that there are many cases that seek to define injury, and they don't define it as when you're, they don't define it as the harm to the person, like you're injured because you have a concussion or something. They define it as a legally cognizable harm, meaning that you have all of the elements of your claim. It's really a discovery rule. So when the court of the Supreme Court in Gladhart took injury to mean when the harm occurred, we also felt that was inconsistent with earlier cases that had defined the word injury much more broadly as meaning discovering your claim. So I think we are concerned that if we don't have this language in the Dash 1 amendments and we just have the main bill, that we may be run into a problem with that word injury again.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherwin.
Just, I guess, see if I can track this then. So the issue here is, let's say, it's hard to identify when harm occurs, I guess, if you've bought seed or something that has some latent. What was it in Gladhart again? What was the product?
It was grapevine rootstock.
Yeah, has some sort of latent disease in it. Easier, I suppose, if the lawnmower throws a blade out the side and cuts your foot or something. And you're suggesting that Gladhart could be interpreted to mean that if that was due to a design defect or a defect in manufacture, that you would still have a 2-year limitation on there because it could have been discovered, even though the injury hasn't occurred until it throws the blade. But if they apply the same rationale, that if the lawnmower was defective when you bought it, that you're barred if the injury occurs 3 years later? Is that what the issue here is, too?
Well, I think the types of products that fall most closely under Gladhart involve pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and products that are cancer-producing with latent injuries that can be happening and you just are not aware that they're happening because they aren't yet producing symptoms, just as the grape stock was not yet showing signs of being infected with the bug. However, we haven't seen a case yet where the injury happens, as you describe, with the lawnmower, and the defect is obvious. I don't know the extent to which those cases will be in jeopardy. But I am very worried about the latent defect cases because that's what Gladhart was.
We have a letter, Linda, that was put into the record by attorneys from the Lindsay Hart firm. I don't know if you've seen that letter or not.
Representative Williams, I just saw it when I came today.
Yeah, and that's the earliest I've seen it. I just read it briefly. But the point that they're obviously making is that I guess they take issue that this should have been a surprise and that the 1977 legislature clearly understood when it adopted the 8-year repose period during the enactment of 3905 that there would be a 2-year period, and they quote, this legislature expressly stated, and the trial attorneys understood that the, quote, tack on statute of limitations period would run from the date of the, quote, occurrence or liability that occurred in the 8-year repose period, citing to a statement apparently from then Representative Kulongoski. And then they go on to point out the exceptions that the legislature over time has passed, the breast implant and the IUD and the like. Uh-huh. Do you have a response to that argument? I mean, you know, I did read the opinion, and I've read materials that your folks have provided. And, I mean, I understand the nature, particularly in the latent defect concept of the issues that are being raised, but it is difficult to look back at the way the court interpreted the statute and come to a conclusion different, given the fact that we've done sort of the exception statutes over the last couple of decades.
Well, I, Representative Williams, I have an explanation. It's a little lengthy, if you can just bear with me.
All right.
I'll try to make it as concise as I can.
I think it'd be instructive for the committee.
As I understand the state of the law, before this statute in 1977, products liability actions were simply treated as negligence actions. And they were in Chapter 12, which is where most of the statutes of limitations exist. And there had been a court-created discovery rule that applied to actions in Chapter 12. So when the legislature met in 1977 to create a products liability section of the law, they were dealing with a state of the law that already had a discovery rule. And from my review of the legislative history, they were simply importing what was already in Chapter 12 and moving it to Chapter 30 so that it would have its own statute of limitations. Everything relating to products liability would be together. And for those of you who care about the distinction between negligence and strict liability, of course, those are part of both parts of product liability, and really there's no strict liability in Chapter 12. So they wanted to create a products liability set of statutes. There's nothing that I could find in the legislative history that suggests that the legislature intended to change the path that the judiciary was taking in creating a discovery rule. It was not even mentioned in any of the hearings or work sessions that I could find. So moving on from there, there hadn't yet been a specific case from the appellate courts where they had actually applied a discovery rule to products liability yet. The issue just hadn't got there. That didn't get there until 1978, the year after this statute was passed. And reading some of the later cases, they suggested that the legislature enacted the statute of repose knowing that the discovery rule was coming to products liability. And in fact, it did come officially in 1982. So when I say that we've been, to get to your question about the exceptions, the first exception statute wasn't enacted until 1983, and by then it was clear because of court opinion that products liability had a discovery rule. So those exceptions were simply writing in what was clearly the existing law, whereas I believe in 1977, they were leaving the issue open for the courts to do what they pretty much knew they were going to do, and they enacted the statute of repose to protect manufacturers when that happened. Is that clear or make sense?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the response. You know, 1977, it all becomes rather hazy as to what anybody intended, but that's... I think it's still important for us to understand your response to this letter.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll hear some other opinions on it before we're done.
Yeah.
Representative Williams.
You're very patient letting Linda talk to us without saying anything, so I'll give you your chance now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda's covered everything so that I don't have to say anything, but I would add, just to follow up with Representative Barker's question, many of those carve-outs, the asbestos, the breast implant situations, are crafted and created to deal with a problem in the ultimate repose area where the harm has not occurred in the 8 years. So we're carving out asbestos cases, breast implant cases, and we're fixing that problem. So although I've read Lindsay Hart's letter, and Jay Beatty over at that office who signed off on this, and I have gone around on some of these, Those carve-outs have been to fix a problem inherent in the 8-year, not the 2-year problem that we're addressing in this case. So I think they stand consistently together. I think much of what is said in Lindsay Hart's letter is not inaccurate in that regard. I think that the problem that was observed or tried to be attempted in 1977 was to have a uniform 10 years, an ultimate repose of 8, and a discovery with 2 years in which to be brought. That's the law we want to return to through 2080-1 amendments.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Well, maybe we can get to the bottom of this and bring this Representative Kulongoski down here.
I don't know what he's doing these days. And I mean that literally. all in good fun. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Okay, who still on the proponent side wants to come up and speak? Does that cover it, Alan?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I know there's some people who've asked to come forward on the opposition side. I know Mr. Marquis and Mr. Cosgrove were on that list. Julie, you want to come up with them too? We'll give everybody obviously the chance. So when they're done, if somebody else wants to speak, you have to raise your hand and we'll call you up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Jim Marquis, today appearing on behalf of Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I've given you a one-page statement in opposition to House Bill 2080. I'm not going to elaborate on that. And I also handed out, I was unaware that the committee, if all of the committee members had the letter from Lindsay Hart, and I've handed that out. I may have the dubious distinction of being the only person in this room that was actually present in the room when all of this happened in 1977, when in the middle of the legislative session, the trial lawyers fired their lobbyist and hired me. I remember this as one of my greatest defeats. In my defense, the 1977 Judiciary Committee was a bastion of conservatism chaired by none other than Hardy Myers, with membership of Ted Kulongoski, of course, Earl Blumenauer, Dave Frohmeyer, and former Treasurer Bill Rutherford. I do remember some of the discussions. My memory, of course, isn't perfect, but we did have discussions regarding whether or not someone beyond the 8 years who had had an injury in the last days of the 8 years would have a right to recover, and that was made clear on the record, I believe, and I think the Lindsay Hart letter outlines that clearly. I really, with all due respect, because I have a great deal of respect for my friends and the trial lawyers, but I really believe the legislature did know what they were doing. If you choose to change this statute because of a policy consideration, I think that's one thing. But I really think that the legislature in 1977 knew exactly what it was doing. And I think that on the floor of the House, when this bill passed with 4 dissenting votes, and I did a little better in the Senate, I got 5 dissenting votes, they knew what they were doing. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, why don't we go to Paul?
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, and I practice law at Lindsay Hart, Neal, and Weigler. Although I did not participate in the writing of the letter, I have reviewed it. I think the chair has already gone through most of the points in that letter. This dispute about what was intended in 1977 may be one of the reasons that the court was led to, in the PGE versus Boley case, to decide that the court should look at the plain language of the law before it gets into, or instead of getting into, the issues of what was actually intended at the legislative hearings. And I think by looking at the plain language of the law, it's clear that the court's decision in Gladhart was correct under that interpretation. It is different from the other statutes that have those other words. It didn't have those other words. I would be also happy to answer questions, although I can't say that I have the history that Mr. Marquis does. And having learned or been, I guess, reminded today about what offensive non-mutual collateral estoppel is, I will engage in defensive mutual stopping of talking. Tried. I it was not as good as
it sounded better before you came up with it, though, didn't it?
Well, it's one of those things where you should stop instead of saying you're going to stop. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's all right. That's all right. We appreciate the effort. You get an E for effort.
Thank you.
Julie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was not here in the 1977 legislature, and I don't work at Lindsay Hart. So, no surprise, I'm sure, to the committee that AOI is coming here in opposition to this bill. It's our understanding that 2080, largely eliminates Oregon's current two-year statute limitations of product liability actions and its eight-year statute of repose, which is the outer limit of time from which the product is sold that a product liability can be brought. The Oregon legislature has dealt with certain situations by allowing a longer period of time for certain products, as we've heard today. We are very concerned about this bill because it will increase product liability lawsuits against employers and Oregon businesses, and it increases the cost of doing business here in Oregon, insurance costs, litigation costs, even cost of record-keeping for, quote-unquote, forever, will increase just so businesses have relevant documents on hand if they're sued at a later time. We feel Oregon's system, current system, is working. It has special rules, as we discussed today, or as you discussed today, in situations that the legislature has deemed appropriate, and a clear and easily administered statute of limitations. So we ask you not to change the current law and not to pass 2080.
Okay, thank you. Question I've got is, and I'm trying to, you know, I mean, it helps for me to sort of draw out the years and sort of pick dates on the little chart as to, okay, if it happened here, then what? Ms. Ironman's testimony, I don't know if it's her testimony, but this memo I've got in my file closes with the line that says, unless the injury occurs within 2 years of the date of purchase, the injured person must rely on discovery in order to maintain an action. Without discovery, the effect is to turn the two-year limitation period into a two-year statute of ultimate repose, which bars a claim before the injury is even known. So in a latent defect case, like the one that is the subject of the Gladhart case, how can you explain to me how it doesn't essentially operate, the lack of a discovery rule, how does it not essentially operate as a two-year ultimate statute of repose if you don't know about it until the two-year period has passed? Now you've figured out you've had an injury, and because of the way the court decided the Gladhart case, you've discovered it, but it's after the two-year period from which you purchased it, which triggered, apparently in Gladhart, the time period. How does that not operate as a two-year bar as opposed to an eight-year bar? I guess that's the question I'd be interested in getting a response to.
And, Mr. Chairman, you're looking at me.
Of the three of you, only one of you is legally impaired.
And that may be the correct title. I'm not sure I can answer that. I know that that is a question that Mr. Pulvers and Mr. Beatty discussed as they were putting together this letter. I didn't participate in the discussion. I saw the end result. I don't know that I can answer that,
but
I'd be happy to get that.
Well, I think that's, to me, the issue that I'm still struggling with on this one is that, you know, I can understand that if you say the ultimate repose is 8 years regardless, which has sort of been the rule in Oregon, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But to say that you have to know about it from the date you purchase something that's got a latent defect in it, that the latent defect triggers after the two-year period of time, then that seems like you've, at least for product, with latent defect claims, developed a potential two-year statute of ultimate repose, which I'm struggling to figure out how those two interplay here, and I think that I'd be interested in other people's views about how that would work, and so that would be a question I'd like a response to.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, in all fairness, I had not seen the -1 amendments until I walked in here today, and our statement and, frankly, our testimony was...
Sure, relates to the original bill.
This bill.
Yeah.
And this bill kind of takes the other tact in that the 8 year, as written, the 8 years is rendered useless because it's, notwithstanding that, 2 years from the date of discovery.
Right, and I
and
think
it extends it forever the other way. So
it potentially could, and I see how that could get people. So I guess what I'd be interested in is people looking at the dash ones and then sort of responding to the issue about, again, it's pretty clear in situations where, you know, you, example, Paul, for your auto manufacturers, you've been in an automobile accident, airbags didn't deploy, or the argument is the airbags didn't deploy. You pretty much know the discovery, at least, likely on that one, and you're going to have a hard time arguing that you didn't know or that you shouldn't have had somebody looking at that issue, and you get to figure that one out later. Different on something like in the Gladhart case or other Great. Kinds of chemical-type cases where there's a potential latent defect, and maybe in the pharmaceutical area the latent defect issue could come up there too. But I think it's the latent defect concept that I'm struggling with on the discovery issue. Representative
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that mine too. You got a situation where basically you run the risk of losing your rights before you even know you've got them. And I think we legislature crafted an 8-year time limit because that seems reasonable. If there's latent defect, it ought to manifest within 8 years, plus the 2-year tack on, I guess, if there's the issue of discovery. But to lose that in a latent claim within 2 years seems awfully harsh. And I'm not sure that I agree that this is, you know, I know we throw bad for business down and we're all supposed to run away from it like it's toxic. But Gladhart was a business plaintiff that lost in this case. And so I don't know that at all. We assume that business is always the defendant, and that's not always true. Business is sometimes the plaintiff in these. And Gladhart is a good example of that, of an Oregon business that lost out. I assume probably suffered some pretty substantial losses if they planted a full vineyard full of diseased vines. And so, you know, I'm not sure that I necessarily buy that this is a bad for business bill. It's really a matter of balance and fairness to me. And business is going to come down on both sides of this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, your point is well taken. Again, I want to say, however, that the Dash 1 are substantially different.
Right.
Than the original bill.
And that's a fair comment. And again, this is more, the purpose of doing this today was to have a sort of an informative dialogue, introduce the issue to the committee so there can be some further discussion. And obviously you've got Dash 1s now to look at, and we'll, you know, get information back from you. Are there further questions for the panel? Okay. Nothing. All right. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wants to come up? Mr. Gallant.
Sorry. Not a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. I, too, have just seen the Dash 1 amendments, and will have those analyzed by our council as well to see the ultimate impact of that. But on its face, the amendment appears to have an impact on physicians who obviously use medical products in a variety of ways and are often included in lawsuits that are filed against manufacturers, whether they be pharmaceutical companies, medical product companies, or others. And we, of course, expend substantial resources in defending physicians in those cases. Quite most often, they are, in fact, withdrawn from the case ultimately, but it requires a large amount of money to go through that process. But even on a quick review of the Dash 1 amendments, the proposal suggests that you would go from essentially a 2-year period to an 8 to 10 year period for a accusation of an omission that a physician might make based on a product that is manufactured by someone else. And in reference to, for example, the breast implant cases, I believe that section essentially exempts itself from any limitation for filing cases and has not really been reviewed in recent years of whether or not that statute should still be on the books. And secondarily, asbestosis cases have been going on for decades and seems to be continuing, just as an observation, a continuing ripe field for litigation, most certainly nationwide, as I think most of you have seen in the popular press. The portion of the bill that retroactively goes back 2 years, I think needs to be reviewed very seriously, well beyond the suggestion that it would only affect a few cases. That seems to me to be overly general, because I don't know that we really know how many cases that might in fact affect or impact that may have been dealt with as well. So this is a major bill in implications and should be viewed very cautiously, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on the implications of it and what impact it may have in a variety of ways. And I look forward to working with you on the proposal.
Representative Shetterly.
Thanks. But again, getting back to my comments before on the cuts both ways kind of aspect of this, can't you foresee a scenario where a physician uses an implant or device and maybe is sued within a two-year period, and the physician, unaware of some latent defect in that device, wants to bring a third-party action against the manufacturer, now be barred under this, potentially. And so now we've just exposed a physician to liability and prevented his or her recourse back to a manufacturer on account of some latent defect that didn't manifest itself until this physician might have unwittingly been using it in reliance on the manufacturer's representations as to the product.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, you're correct, which is why I would suggest that we need to look at this very carefully. It was a little troubling to hear a previous panelist say that physicians might be left holding the bag if other potential litigants were excluded from the litigation, which is troubling in the sense that it's very unusual, at least to my knowledge, that in products cases, the physician or healthcare provider, could be a hospital or others, would knowingly use a product with either a latent defect or otherwise. So I'm not sure that's really the approach or the philosophy that I would certainly espouse during this era of liability.
Further questions? Okay, thank you, Scott. Anybody else? Floyd?
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, it sounds like we're going to leave this bill for consideration another time. Does the Chair have any thoughts as to what our time frame may be, knowing the push that we're getting from the Speaker's office to move stuff?
One of the many mysteries of the universe, Representative Nancy.
It is. I come to seek the answer.
Well, you and I can climb that mountain together someday. Okay. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2080, and we will... We'll adjourn the committee. Committee members, just so...